questions.
I'm ready too.
All right, good. Let me grab my Bible.
That might be
helpful. That's a good thing.
You might want to look at Romans 12:18, actually.
Okay.
That's where the first question comes from. Romans 12:18, so far as it depends upon you. Live at peace with all men. What is our responsibility long term with a person who will not reconcile in a conflict?
Okay. And I'm going to move closer to Scott because I feel like I'm in conflict with him and we have a division between us. So there, we've been reconciled now. So that almost sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it almost sounds like the question has to do with you're wondering if you've done enough, and what do I do if after all my efforts to try to be reconciled, the person refuses?
It seems to indicate that the other party is the unwilling party, and this has lasted for a long time. Yeah.
Okay.
What's your continued responsibility?
Right. And that is a good verse.
Maybe do you have a continued responsibility?
Yeah. So I think not only that verse, but I think of Ephesians 4:3, which we read this morning, endeavor to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. So whether the other person is willing to be reconciled or not, I can't control people, so I can't force people to repent. That's between them and God. But I'm responsible to have a clear conscience before the Lord. So I need to do everything I need to do to try to be reconciled. But even if they, but when they are not, let's, for the sake of the question, let's say when they're not willing, if I know that I have exhausted everything that I know to do to try to be reconciled with the person, I believe I can have a clear conscience before the Lord. And I'll give you some examples. I have broken relationships. And I'll tell you just another one, that just to make the point. John MacArthur has broken relationships. So when you're in leadership, there's going to be people that don't like you. And I've had plenty of people that don't like me through the years. You know, you teach something biblically and they just don't like it, and I've tried to be reconciled with people and they won't have anything to do with it. Even the week before we moved to California to start ministry at the Master's College, we moved from Virginia, there were people that had left the church that I pastored there that were really hopping mad at me. They thought I was the devil incarnate for the type, some of the things that I was teaching and promoting in the church. And even the week before we moved, I thought, okay, I'm going to try at least one more time to try to get reconciled with these people. And they refused to meet, or one person just said, no, we don't, the person is more of a peace faker, and they, no, we don't need to talk about it. I knew we needed to talk about it, but I can't force people to meet. So I'm called to do everything I can do, and my conscience is clear before the Lord that I tried to get reconciled with them. If I've wronged, there's people that I've confessed to where I thought I was wrong, and I believe that they haven't forgiven me. And I'll look forward, if they're, you know, they're really followers of Christ, I'm going to look forward to being reconciled to them in heaven someday. But I just don't know what else to do. In my mind, I've exhausted all the means that I know to try to get those relationships healed. And I think that's just realistic. We live on a fallen planet, and to think that every time, if I use peacemaker principles or biblical principles, everybody will always kiss and make up and we're always going to have reconciliation. Well, that's not a realistic view of humanity, because we live on a fallen planet. So the best answer I can give is, as far as depends on you, exhaust the biblical means that you know, realizing that you can't force people to use biblical principles. Be humble, accept your own responsibility, confess sin if you need to, and if they don't want to have anything to do with it, That's between them and God. And I believe your conscience can be clear. Looks like there's a follow-up to that.
Your follow-up question with the unreconciled party there is, at what time does Matthew 18 come into play?
Yeah, so I there's all kinds of scenarios to that. Like, what if they're not part of your church? People, like I'm, some of the ones I'm thinking of, they're people that are not part of the same church that I attended. And then there's issues of, you know, when does it become a discipline matter? So I think there's all kinds of scenarios there that you'd have to consider of, you know, is this a rebellious person? Is the person a believer? So there's lots of different options there that you'd have to think through.
All right, so it's going to depend on the situation there.
Yeah.
Essentially. Yep. Okay. As far as personality conflicts go, that phrase, personality conflict, is there such a thing as a personality conflict? And how, if so, how can the gospel and sanctification change a personality?
Okay. In essence, we really were addressing that question because... I didn't show you this one slide, but one of the interesting slides related to the heart comes from a resource called the Theological Word Book of the Old Testament. And this guy, one of the main editors, absolutely brilliant guy with languages, named Gleason Archer. And he wrote in this resource on Theological Word Book of the Old Testament, under the article on the heart, that the word heart... This is almost an exact quote. The term heart is the richest biblical term for what is traditionally known as the personality. So when you think about what personality is how you think about life, how your emotions respond to life, how you make decisions about life. Well, what did I just say? Mind, will, and emotions. So what we biblically think of, or what the culture would think of as personality, biblically we would think that's very much being shaped by the heart. Yeah, it's a reflection of my heart, who I am as a person, etc. So are there personality conflicts? Absolutely, because there's hearts in conflict with each other. And what was the second part of that question?
The second part was, how can the gospel and sanctification change a, quote, personality?
Right. You're not hearing me say there aren't fixed or there aren't traits that we have with personality. The thing that intrigues me is the psychologies have a lot of theories about personalities, and not to get too technical here, but every major psychology. So whether it's Freud's psychology, Adler's psychology, Maslow's psychology, they disagree with one another. They all had a view of the personality. So there isn't one set secular view that this is the personality theory. Every psychology has a personality theory. Well, biblical counseling has a personality theory as well, and you're hearing, are there created tendencies that are ours genetically, of course, but are there parts that are influenced by my heart, etc.? And the answer is yes. Well, the heart's the mind, the will, the emotions, and as I'm growing in sanctification, the way I think about life, the decisions I make about life, how I emotionally respond to life, my affections, appetites and passions, everything that we've talked about with the heart, all those things start to get influenced by the gospel, right? So, praise God, we don't believe, the secular culture would talk about fixed personality. Well, we don't believe that personality is fixed. I believe that we're becoming like the personality, which is our Savior. and there's more and more of Ernie Baker that is being shed, if I understand the doctrine of progressive sanctification, and I would say my experience of the last 40 years, because I've been a believer for 40 years now, and would say I've tried to walk with the Lord seriously for 40 years now, that I'm a very different person than I was 40 years ago. And praise God for that. So if you would have known me as a, I'm just so you know, you won't, I might, this might fit in a little bit tomorrow, but I was the kid that you warned your teenagers about. So there's hope. So I'm the one that you would tell your kids, don't hang around Ernie Baker, because I was the bitter, nasty, angry, rebellious kid that tried to cause trouble and made my school teachers miserable and my parents miserable. So the gospel works, exhibit A, and personalities can change. We're not stuck.
All right, the next question is this. It often seems the pressures on the leader's time are so great. Often conflict is unaddressed because life is busy. Intentions are good. How have you been faithful to address everything adequately when ministry life is so full?
That's good. I'm going to backtrack to the other question just a moment. Comment about the heart, just to make it really clear. So what we're saying with personalities is at least a significant part of personality conflicts from a, I would say, a biblical perspective is you have hearts in conflict with each other. It's mind, will, emotions rubbing against each other. Now, to that question, leaders and conflict. Let me clarify, first of all, I haven't always been faithful and have many times been busy and overwhelmed, and things have been neglected that, just so we're all being honest here and remembering we live in a Genesis 3 world and there is no such thing as perfection. So I don't think there is perfection for any church leader to perfectly handle church conflicts. No church elder can do that perfectly. No husband and wife can do that perfectly, but we sure can try. So it's interesting to think about what causes leaders to be busy. And from my experience, it's we get busy in ministry running programs, events, etc. And it's those kind of things that dominate time, so it seems like it's really hard to have the private meeting with somebody because you're already tired from running events. And you're, as a pastor, many times I felt like a program director, like I'm, you know, I got to keep all the plates spinning and I got to staff all these different programs that we're running. And, but if you switch your mentality that ministry is not about programs, and this takes a major switch in ministry philosophy. Ministry is not about programs. Ministry is about people. And people, so instead of viewing, I'm sure you've heard this statement, wouldn't ministry be great if it weren't for the people? Well, ministry is people. Ministry is not programs. And I used to joke with our Awana leaders in Virginia, I think you guys could run the Awana ministry without the children. You know, okay, 7 o'clock to 7:30 is handbook time. Oh, there's no children. Okay, that's okay. Next half an hour, we're having handbook time. Oh, and then we're going to have a half an hour game time. Oh, there's no children. Oh, that's okay. And it's just about running the program and forgetting that it's all about people. But if you switch your thinking that ministry is always primarily about people, and maybe we shouldn't be running all the programs that are exhausting us, so we had more time for people ministry, we'd have more time to be able to do this reconciliation type stuff and have the talks that are necessary. And so
So do you think that some of that might just come down to your priorities as well, and maybe what you think is important and what you are going to invest in?
Most definitely. Okay. Yeah. I guess I'm also addressing the idea that churches can keep people awfully busy. You know.
Yes, they can.
So as a pastor, I used to wonder whether my church was my friend or my enemy with my own kids. You know, having six kids, and we had pretty strong convictions about being home early on Saturday night so that we could get to bed and have a good night's sleep so that I didn't have people yawning on Sunday morning during the big event of the week, you know, when we're worshiping God and everybody's tired because they were up late Saturday night. And so I wonder sometimes, especially the American church, if we're much too program-oriented rather than people-oriented. And if we were more people-oriented, we'd have more time to have peacemaking conversations and work through issues. And
that's great. Thank you.
Yeah.
Here's a question regarding believer versus unbeliever and how you respond to conflict. Conflict resolution seems to make sense biblically to Christians. How do you approach a non-Christian in a conflict situation?
Okay. If you look on your peacemaker brochure, this is one of the areas where the new wording excels. So the old wording that I was using and that I'll use tomorrow really works well with believers, but even this wording works well with unbelievers. And to a certain degree, I mean, these same principles work with an unbeliever. So I'll just give you an example. Your neighbor's dog is barking, and your neighbor's dog is barking, and your neighbor's dog is barking. Well, what do you do? Well, the first thing you might say is, I call the police. Well, if you look on the slippery slope, accountability is the last thing of our options. So holding them accountable to the police, why not first one? And the old wording is, go talk to your neighbor one-on-one, Matthew 18. And if that doesn't work, why don't you get one or two others to go with you? Why escalate it the whole way to the police right away? And so what you're hearing me say is that to some degree or another, these same ideas work even with unbelievers. Peacemaker Ministries has an interesting booklet that is called Peacemaking in the Workplace, and how to use these same peacemaker principles even with unbelievers. And one of my students, just to give you an example of this, so an MABC student, Master of Arts in Biblical Counseling student, was at conflict with one of his coworkers, not a believer. And he just started practicing what he knew he needed to do with the unbeliever, and they were reconciled. So on the back of the brochure, he wrote up, his testimony, by the way, is on the Biblical Counseling Coalition website of being reconciled, something like workplace dispute, being reconciled with my unbelieving coworker or something like that. And he went through the seven A's of confession with her. He had sinned against her. He humbled himself. He went and asked her for forgiveness using the seven A's of confession, and they were reconciled. So to some degree, you can use these exact same principles with unbelievers. Can you practice church discipline with an unbeliever? Obviously not. But a lot of the same principles will work.
That's great. And also, you should maybe keep in mind what expectations you have as to how they might respond. It might, obviously, yep. You have the potential with a believer being able to respond in a Christ-like way by the Holy Spirit, but that doesn't mean, of course, you can't, like you said, have some reconciliation with an unbeliever as well.
And who knows, you might get an opportunity to share the gospel, because they may wonder, okay, why are you suddenly such a changed, humble person? And you get this opportunity, why did you come and confess your sin? Well, it's because of what the Lord's done for me.
Yeah, great point. Within the context of our church or any congregation, what's the best way for a congregational member to address issues that they may have with a leader? And then We'll stick with that, but I want to let you know the second part. What would be the best way for the leadership to respond to the individual to let the individual know the issue was addressed or taken seriously? So we'll start with what's the best way for a congregational member to address issues that they may have with a leader?
That is a really wonderful question and really crucial. I mean, all of us live in relationships where we have to appeal to people in accountability or who are in authority over us, right? So whether it's children with parents or maybe a wife with a husband or a church member with the elders or even the civil authorities, how do you appeal to people who are in authority? And often that does not go well, appealing to people in authority. Or I talked to my marriage and family class about this. You know, how do you appeal to your parents? What does a good appeal to parents look like? What's a bad appeal to parents look like? What does it look like to sound respectful? So just a couple of really quick things. One would be not by email. Just to be really practical, email is not the way to do conflict resolution because you can't read facial expressions. Anonymous letters, that is really nasty. Anonymous letters, that doesn't go over well with church leaders when people write anonymous letters, and it violates lots of biblical principles, like Matthew 18, of going to your brother face to face. But when I think of going to someone in authority, think of Nathan confronting David. You talk about a tense situation, right? How would you like to have been in his place? And you got to confront David over his sin. Well, what did he do? He told a story and posed questions. And I found that to be a really powerful way to be respectful, but yet to try to help the person in leadership understand your perspective. So you might say something like, could you imagine just for a moment that you're me, and so you're talking to your pastor or elder. Can we imagine for a moment I'm the pastor and you're me? And from my perspective, this, 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 and this happened. What might you be thinking? What might you be perceiving or thinking in the situation? Or posing questions, rather than just making direct statements of, you guys ought to do this better, or send the email of, here's where I see the elders failing, here, 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 and here. Why not pose questions and just try to stimulate conversation? And then tomorrow we're going to hear this principle called the pause principle, which is pretty much at the core of it is, how do you hear people well? How do you pose questions that really draw people out to understand what is the deeper concern? So now I'm addressing this second part of it, is how do the leaders send the message that they're really listening, is that they learn how to listen well. And I'll tell this story in more detail tomorrow, but I joke and say that if pastors were given medals for the worship wars, I'd have a chest full of them. Because we were a very traditional church there in Virginia, and we were trying to change our worship philosophy, which meant also partly a change of worship style. And that did not go over well in the church. It was a really, really, really big issue. Like, that would have been, in my church, that was very sinful. Or having guitars on the platform was extremely sinful because the devil lives in a drum set. That's what people told me. And I had to decide, how am I going to battle this issue? Is it going to be, are we going to debate over, is it right or wrong to have drums on a church platform? Or am I going to try to get below the surface and understand what's the deeper concern? And we did ministry in a university town, so almost everybody in the church had their PhD or master's degree. So every man on the church board had a PhD or master's degree, and at any given time I'd have 30 PhDs in the church and many, 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 many people with master's degrees. So when we started having these debates, they know how to write, and we had position papers flying all over the church. People were standing outside the door on Sunday morning in the parking lot handing people their position papers on church music, and then people would write response to their position papers, and it was just getting chaotic of how everybody was responding to the worship war that was going on. So as church leaders, we actually had somebody buy a box of books that was against contemporary music, and he was standing at the door handing out his books, and I had to go up to him as the pastor and just say, cease and desist. You're not allowed to do this anymore. So making a long story short, how do leaders listen well? We started asking, instead of debating, is it right or wrong to have drums on the platform, we started asking the question, what do drums and guitars on the platform represent to you? What's your fear? What's your concern? And we started hearing commonality of fears and concerns, and that the common fear and concern that we were hearing by far was, this represents doctrinal compromise. Well, that gave me an issue as a pastor I could sink my teeth into. I was having a hard time sinking my teeth into, okay, how do you write a music philosophy and debate whether it's right or wrong to have drums on a church platform? That's just like this nebulous issue. Are we sinking into doctrinal compromise? That's a meaty issue. And so we started addressing it at that level, and believe me, the congregation knew we were listening, because we were trying to address the fears and concerns. I think of it as, instead of the surface issue, what's the below the surface issue? What are the fears or concerns? So that's how I'd answer the second part. You can send a message to the congregation that you're really listening by addressing fears and concerns and not just the surface issue.
All right, we are just about at time. I do have a few more questions that I would love to ask, but I'm not sure that we have the time. Do we have the time?
What time are you ending?
What time were we supposed to end?
Four, I thought.
At four? Oh, good. We do have the time. Outstanding. Okay, next question. What encouragement can you give to a wife who struggles with the warlike response with her husband and children, but gives into peace-faking fear of man with church members?
Whoever wrote the question, first of all, thank you for being honest and being...
Yeah, what should I focus on was the end of that.
Right. So, well, how to do it and what to focus on are going to be two different answers, but which one to focus on I think is a quick answer, and that is your family, because you're living with them every day, and they're the people that have to put up with you, and so, you know, your responses at home are, I mean, that's just absolutely crucial to just having a more harmonious day-to-day life. How to do it, that was, which one were the control responses? That's how I think of that, is it just could be control-type themes. And if it is a control-type theme that leads to the war-type response because you want your home to be the way you want it and people aren't cooperating with your system, think of themes. So we battle false worship with true worship, and in that regard, the true worship I think of is to focus on that God's in control, that life, if you really want life to work when it feels like it's out of control, you have to focus on who is the God who's in control, even when my life feels out of control. And so I normally recommend the book Trusting God Even When Life Hurts by Jerry Bridges to help that person who's a control type freak, and I don't know this person, so don't take this personally, please, because I don't know who you are, but Trusting God by Jerry Bridges, if it's a control type theme, and that just is a great book to get your mind directed upwards, that even when my family's not cooperating with me to do things the way I want them to do things, that there is a God who's over everything. He has life always in control. Even when government seems out of control, the world seems out of control, he's not. Scripture affirms that over and over. So that's just some quick thoughts. I'd work on the family first, though.
All right. I think that's interesting that you can have different responses with different people and, you know, be on one side of the slope at one point and another side of the slope at another point.
And it's easier to be unguarded at home because there is something to the statement, familiarity breeds contempt. And these are the people you're with, and you just let your guard down, and you don't care as much what they think. And it's a shame when you think about it, but you're more guarded with people at church because you do really care about what they think of you. And
sure, sure. And I'd say that, it's, you know, if whoever wrote that question needs to understand that that's a struggle many, if not most, people have as well.
Right.
Like 1 Corinthians 10:13 says, there's no temptation that has overtaken you except such as is common to man.
Oh.
And they're not alone. I see those tendencies in me too.
Right.
I mean, I know how I can respond with my family at home and yeah, want to please people at church. I think it's interesting that, do you see would there be one thing, do you think, that is leading in? There may be two different responses, but do you think there's a central issue going on there that maybe connects the two?
Well, control definitely can be tied in with people pleasing, that I want to control what people think of me.
Okay.
So appearances become very important. I want to give off an impression to people. And so I will control the way, I want to control what people think of me and my family. I get upset at my family when you're not fitting my pattern because I'm embarrassed what people might think of us if they knew what we were really like. Mm-hmm. So those two things definitely can be connected.
Right. And the pronouns I hear you using is I, me,
yes,
mine.
That's right.
And a lot of, I mean, it's kind of the self is the center of a lot of, well, it is what we do in our sin, so. Thank you.
Issue with every single one of us.
Yeah, just different expressions, right?
Right.
I think I just flipped this around. Let me see here. Ah, how do we discern when a matter needs to be addressed as a conflict? When is it okay as a leader to just overlook a matter and cover it in love?
This will get talked about in a little more detail tomorrow. When is it? So on your diagram again, in the slippery slope, the very first response on the top is overlook. And the problem is, so 1 Peter 4, Proverbs talks about love covers a multitude of sins. And of course, we want to be gracious people, and we want to be merciful with people. But the problem comes if you're over on this left side, you want to overlook everything, right? And you tell yourself things like, I'll be the servant, and I don't want to make a big deal out of it, and it's okay. Once you start recognizing the heart behind that, that you may be a people pleaser, and that's that it's not really what we would call peacemaking, where you're purposely overlooking is a form of forgiveness, where you are purposely saying, I am going to let love cover that, and I'm going to let it go. I forgive you. That's different than just saying, oh, forget about it. I'm just going to bury it. And we would call that peace faking, which comes out of a person who is not fully aware of their heart tendencies to be a people pleaser or a comfort lover, and they want to cover everything. So that type of, that's the person I'm going to address. If you're a peace faker and you're the type who really wants to cover everything, you're going to have to discipline yourself to get up on top of the slippery slope and move toward other people and address issues, because you know you have this false tendency to overlook too many things. Now, we teach people that the line here between overlook and going toward the other person, you know that by answering some questions. So let's now assume that we're switching away from the person who overlooks too much, and that this is a legitimate overlooking. You really want to love the person. So the question becomes, I can't overlook it because it would not be loving to do that. So it's not about, I'm going to go talk to them because I'm mad at you and I want to punish you with my tongue. Let's assume, or I assume, that the biblical principle would be, you've already forgiven. You want to cover it. But I'm going to talk to the other person because I love them. I want to see them deal with this area in their life that they need to deal with, and it would not be loving to overlook it. So the way I like to word the question for myself is, what is in the best interest of the person long term? Is it in the best interest of the person for me to overlook it? Because maybe this is just something, like, I'll give you an example. Maybe I wake up grouchy and Rose is thinking in her mind, okay, I'm going to be patient with Ernie today. He had a bad night. I know he had a bad night because I felt him bouncing around in the bed all night long and he didn't rest well. And so she's being very patient with me that I'm impatient in the morning. But if I wake up the next morning and I'm grouchy, and I wake up the next morning and I'm grouchy, and I wake up the next morning and I'm grouchy, love shouldn't cover that, right? Love would say, I see a pattern in your life. Proverbs talks about what's the direction the person's going. And I'm looking at this pattern. I shouldn't overlook it if I'm seeing a direction. So what's in the best interest of the person long term? And if it's loving, sometimes it's the loving thing to do to say, I'm just going to be patient with you and I'm going to overlook it. Other times it's, no, I've been gracious enough. It's time to talk. There's this pattern in your life because you see the direction that the person is headed. Now, there are some other questions that we use, but I'll cover those in a little more detail tomorrow.
Great. Last question. You had mentioned before, I believe it was marriage mediation.
Right.
And that's different from marriage counseling. And
right.
So this question, the person wants you to explain the difference.
Good. Thank you. I love doing marriage mediation, so thank you for letting me end on this. Marriage counseling is more long-term, and I do both, by the way, and I'm regularly having to decide with this couple, is this a marriage mediation or is this a marriage counseling? And I'm almost at the place where I would like to do marriage mediation with everybody and then do marriage counseling for the issues that didn't get resolved for mediation. But mediation is a short-term model. It's where I have everybody, the husband and wife, read Peacemaking for Families. They have to do homework out of the ends of the chapters because I want to get them ready for the actual mediation. And I've done mediations on all kinds of issues, from parents being unreconciled to their 20-something-year-old children to lots of marriage mediations, like the story I told you this morning about the pastor and his wife, or earlier about the pastor and his wife. But what we do in mediation is we have three or four individual meetings with, let's say, the husband and the wife to get them ready for the actual mediation. They're individually doing homework to help discover individually what led to their marriage being in the condition that it's in. During the pre-mediation, we're discovering what are the issues that are keeping these people separate from one another. What are their typical complaints? What are the things that are the barriers in their relationship? And it's typically things like money, sex, kids, and in-laws, or variations of those themes. And so three or four individual meetings to get them ready for the mediation. They're doing homework. They've read the Peacemaking for Families book. And then we meet for a day and a half or 2 days solid. And I do a full-blown mediation for 10 hours, 16 hours, and we take breaks to eat. We might meet from 9 to 5 one day and 9 to 5 the next day, and we're working through all of those issues, and we use the agenda is based on the word gospel, and each letter of the word gospel represents a different part of the agenda where we're actually working through the issues The L of gospel is lead to agreement. And we, at by the very end, they, through those whole days, day and a half or days of mediation, they are confessing sin to one another. They've been prepared to do that through the pre-mediation. Now during the mediation, they're actually at, they use the seven A's of confession. They promise forgiveness to each other. They bring up the issues. We confess heart themes, false worship themes, and then we brainstorm. The E of gospel is explore options. And so we are brainstorming what are solutions to all these issues, and we work together as a team of how are we going to get answers to this money issue? How are we going to get answers to this issue related to we visit your in-laws more than we go to my parents' house? And the L then is lead to agreement, and we actually write based upon the consensus of what we come together. We write a document up called a redemptive agreement, and they leave the marriage mediation with a signed document of what they are agreeing to do as a couple to work on rebuilding their marriage. I can do all of that, four meetings and a mediation, in about a five-week period of time, them reading the book, doing homework. And the reason I like that is because they leave with more hope. And if issues come up that are more long-term issues, we assign them then to marriage counseling. And but before, they wouldn't even have done marriage counseling because they were so hopeless in their marriage. So the mediation can restore hope to a hopeless marriage. And I'm thinking more of crisis marriages where you want to tear down barriers of things that where they're feeling hopeless and they don't even want to talk about the issues anymore. Now they're willing to do marriage counseling because you restored some hope, because they actually ended the mediation with an agreement and they've confessed sin to each other and et cetera. I've seen it work beautifully. And then issues, the long-term counseling issues naturally bubble to the surface and you recognize that's not really a mediation issue. That's going to take more time to work through. And we assign that to a marriage counseling type of scenario. So I like doing marriage mediations. They're hard work, but really rewarding because you see couples get reconciled and it's beautiful to see.
All right, thank you. That ends our Q&A session. So thank you, Dr. Baker, for your...
Ernie.
Thank you, Ernie, for your pre-conference.
Thank you, Scott.
All right. Before we take off, I did want to remind everyone that we are opening the registration for the conference, registration table and the book table at 6:15 tonight.